welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Joe Leach, a UX and product guy and author of Psychology for Designers. And today's topic is International UX. This episode is brought to you by Balsamic Mockups. Balsamic Mockups is a low-fidelity wireframing tool. Basically, it's like sketching on a notepad or whiteboard, but at the computer. The idea is to get the structure of your user interface idea down before you start coding or sweating the details in Photoshop. Try it free for 30 days at balsamic.com. Hey, Joe.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for making it today.
No problem. Good to be here.
So we'll start with a brief questionnaire just to learn more about you. Mm-hmm. And question number one is, what do you do for a living?
So I am a freelance consultant and I help big companies and small startups with product strategy. So, you know, what to build, who to build it for, when to build it, as well as user experience. So user research, some UI design work. And I said, yeah, I work for big companies, people like Raspberry Pi Foundation, Museum of Modern Art in New York, I've worked with recently, as well as Marriott Hotels, Disney, eBay, people like that. And then a handful of startups I also work with too.
That sounds very, very impressive. Oh, how did you get to such big name clients and everything you have today?
Well, I've been doing, I've been in the UX game for about 13 years now, and we'll probably get to this in a minute, but I started out before I was a UX person. I was an English teacher. I taught English abroad to speakers of other languages. So I worked in Spain and France and Japan and a variety of places. And so when I first got into user experience, early on, I met the folks from Marriott when I was the agency I was working at before, and they needed help with international user experience. And I'd done some user experience work. I've got a master's in human computer interaction, but more importantly for them, I had experience in dealing with people from different parts of the world and languages and understanding what their needs were and how they thought and felt and behaved. So, the teaching and my master's course kind of was a good combination for me to get into user experience.
Which was first? Was it teaching languages or was it getting that that degree in neuroscience?
So the degree was first. You know, 18 years old when you're going into university, you have no real idea what you want to do. So I went to university to study. I had the choice between studying neuroscience or computer science, and I chose neuroscience because the people I met in the neuroscience department were much more interesting than the computer science people. Sorry, computer science geeks. And so I did that at 18. And then after university, you know, the wilderness years where you don't really know what to do with your life. So I did a teacher training course and I moved abroad to teach English. And I thought I'd just do it for the summer and ended up doing it for about 6 years. And then I came back following that teacher training course and I did a master's course in human computer interaction, which is the sort of the kind of master's course that user experience people do when they first start. So a mix of psychology and computer science. So that's my brief career before I actually got into UX.
I think that first education gives you a completely unfair competitive advantage over other UX designers who just have, you know, design or computer science education.
Well, exactly. I'd like to say that was the plan from day one, but it was never the plan, Jane. It never was. But yeah, it does give me a good perspective on things, user experience. I've got that psychology and neuroscience background, hence writing the book Psychology for Designers. I kind of attempted to distill a lot of the stuff that I'd learned on my psychology master's and my neuroscience degree into a frame of reference for designers and user experience people.
And if you a few more words about how you got from your, you know, first UX clients towards those names that you mentioned. I'm sure it wasn't like one day transition.
I mean, I started working for an agency. So I my first job out of university really was for a user experience agency called CX Partners, and they were really good to me. And they were just starting themselves and they were quite small. And we just happened to be in the same sort of circles that, and we met somebody from Marriott at a conference, a user experience conference. And don't forget, this was 13 years ago. So there wasn't very many people doing UX back then. And so there weren't small companies wanting UX because they didn't know what it was and they probably couldn't afford it. So it was only the big folks that were really looking for it. And they came to CX Partners, the agency I was working with, looking for experience within the UK market, because they're a US company, and they identified the fact that the UK is different from the USA in terms of what user needs are and language. And that kind of then went, I was the natural person at CX Partners to start working with Marriott, because I had that experience in international, having lived abroad and worked with loads of international people, I kind of understood the differences that would help them. So it actually did start with a big client, because back then they were the only people who wanted user experience and could have kind of afford to pay for it as well. So I was lucky enough to start big, and kind of I've just carried on ever since, really.
Amazing story. And these days, what does your typical day look like?
So I work from home, which is great. I've got a new daughter. She's 13 weeks old, so she's very young.
Congratulations.
So my day starts with her. Thank you. My day starts with her waking me up. And she's very nice, that. She's always very smiley in the morning. So I sort of look after her till about 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. And then I basically work with a variety of clients, because I'm a consultant rather than a contractor. I sort of offer my expertise to help rather than kind of going into an office and doing 9 to 5. So all my days are different. So I work with a big US software company called Alfresco, and I might have a couple of calls with them in the morning. Might do a little bit of work, but then I also do, because I'm UK based, I also do work with Asia and with the US. So the morning tends to be calls with Asia first thing, because that is the overlap of time zones. And then the afternoon, evening tends to be more US calls, because again, that's the overlap of time zones. So I sort of use the bit in the middle of my day to do work, really.
I hear you.
And that work is anything from writing. So today I've been writing international strategy. So a way of planning how to approach each individual language and country differently for a big company. And I've also been doing a bit of work on a new book that I'm writing as well. So yeah, just my day is very varied, and I typically have got 4 or 5 things that I'm sort of working on at any one point.
Mm-hmm. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
So the thing that I enjoy most is the variety. So I, on the one hand, I might be working with a document management software company, through to a hotel company, through to Raspberry Pi, who, you know, make hardware, through to startups. So startups I'm working with at the moment, I'm working on one that's trying to revolutionize the funeral care system, another one that looks at voluntary and volunteer work, so doing volunteer work. I'm working another one that works with small business finance. So I love the variety of different markets and areas that I can kind of look at and get involved with. That's the stuff I like the most. The stuff I like the least, because I'm freelance, it's trying to get people to chasing invoices and getting paid. The little guys are really good at paying you, so the startups are always really good at paying you because they understand. But big companies, especially US companies, are dreadful at paying you quickly or when you need it. So that's the worst thing, is having to chase money. I hate it.
Okay, I hear you. What is your next big thing?
So my next big thing is I am writing a book, actually, which is a framework for applying psychology to product design. So how to apply psychology on the micro level to interaction and on the macro level to user experience, and how product managers, user experience people and designers can get to grips with applying psychology. So rather than kind of one of those books which is an epic list of 1,000 psychology studies, it's more of a framework to apply it alongside your design process and your product process. That's what I'm working on at the moment, is the book.
Sounds awesome. Is there a working title or maybe a URL for the book?
There is a working title. I'm calling it. It's really hard because the title was the most important part. And it's still early days. So the working title is UX Psychology and the Power of 100. So the Power of 100 being the kind of framework I'm working on. And I'm actually doing a couple of conference talks on it this year coming up. I've got one up in Manchester in the UK and one in Bristol later this year. So I'm kind of using my conference talks to sort of hone the ideas down and get feedback from the audience. So that's what it's called now, and that's what it's called at the next couple of conferences, but I can't be sure if the book's going to be called that. And no, there's no website yet. You know, it's they say that the cobbler's children have the worst shoes or something like that, as they say. That web people are really bad at putting together their own websites for their own thing. So I should have a website for it, but I haven't got one yet.
Right, I'm totally with you on that. Could you give us a hint? 100 of what is the power of?
So 100 is the idea that you have the perfect mental capacity that we all have is, say, 100. So 100% is perfect mental capacity. But the modern world that we're living in is, you know, maybe you're watching TV with your when you're using an app on your phone, or the kids are screaming in the background when you're trying to, you know, take out car insurance on a website. Maybe you're hungry, you're tired. You've got a choice of 15 different products to solve one problem. It's all of these things in the modern world mean that when we're using products digitally, we're not 100% engaged with everything, and we're not 100% at full 100% cognitive capacity. And so it's a framework to understand how we can design for people who are living in the modern world. They're stressed, they're tired, they're hungry, they've got a lot going on in their life. How do we better build products that fit into their lives? And it's the psychology of that, really.
Well, yeah, that's a fascinating idea. So true. So let's proceed to international UX, and it's going to be super exciting because I know zero about that, even though I'm from Russia, so I know at least about two countries. But your website says that you've run UX projects in 38 countries.
Yes.
That's impressive.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's only because I've worked with people like eBay, Disney and Marriott, who operate globally anyway, that I've had to do that, really. So it's always been with those folks that I've had to go and kind of do that work with, really.
And yeah, that's super awesome. So I think there would be a few use cases for such kind of skill, such as international design. One of them probably would be an existing product or company launching into a new market. Another one would be accommodating for these features from scratch. How, just in general, what's the first rule to approach international design when you know nothing about it, but you need to?
Yeah, so the most important thing is international doesn't mean translation. Translation is the kind of default option for a lot of companies. They go, oh, okay, we want to take our US product and launch it in Russia, for example. So what we'll do is we'll just get all of our content translated. We'll, you know, put a website up with a .ru domain name, and all the customers will suddenly come to our website. That's the biggest rule I say, is international does not just mean translation.
But then what does it mean?
So that, well, there we go. It's, what does it mean? So it means understanding the culture itself and the kind of context of how people use stuff in that country. So if we take Russia, which is a country you know pretty well.
Maybe we should pick another country so that I learn something new.
All right, let's take... So the hardest country of all of them to design for is Japan. It's by far and away the most challenging market to ever work in. So... in fact, tell you what, here's a good example. Let me talk about Arabic countries, because those are countries I know a lot about. I'll talk about Japan at the end, because that's a sort of special use case on its own. But let's talk about Arabic. So I have worked with a number of organizations who say, yeah, great, we've got an Arabic website, and it's, you know, we launched it last year and it's translated, but it's not performing very well. So, you know, maybe our conversion on our main website for selling things is 10%, but on our Arabic website, it's like 1%. And that's pretty typical, that most existing brands and countries, when they operate abroad, their conversion is typically between 10% or 50% of their home market that they understand really well. And they often don't know why. And it's a number of factors. So if we take Arabic as an example, the big thing about Arabic is that Arabic is not tied to one country. So Arabic is spoken across the Middle East. So it's spoken from kind of Saudi Arabia in the Middle East on the one end, right through across North Africa, right through to places like Tunisia in North Africa. And the Arabic that's spoken in Saudi Arabia is different from the Arabic that's spoken in Egypt and Syria and Algeria and Tunisia. And a lot of companies don't quite understand that. They're like, well, Arabic's Arabic, isn't it? And you, of course, wouldn't know that if you didn't know that about Arabic. So that typically means that you then have to... Translation doesn't work, because what you write about and the things that are going to attract... somebody from Saudi Arabia who's buying, say, a pair of shoes on the website is going to be different from somebody who is buying a pair of shoes in Egypt. There's going to be different words that they're going to appeal to them. There's going to be different fashions. There's going to be different cultural norms around shoe wearing. There's going to be a whole variety of different things that are different from one Arabic speaker to another Arabic speaker. And so it's, for me, it's always about understanding the culture first and the users and what their needs and wants are, before you just basically just translate your website into Arabic. And a lot of companies just don't do that. They'll just translate it because it's cheap and it's easy. And there are lots of third-party services that will translate your website cheaply that they think, oh, you know, internationalization is done. We've translated our website. And it's not as simple as that.
Absolutely. I've heard stories about IKEA, because they're like one of the global companies, how dramatic their changes were when they were adopting new markets. So that would be quite similar for any kind of product, I guess.
It is. So we talk about Marriott. So again, I've got a lot of experience in doing this with Marriott. So if you go to a Marriott hotel in the US or in the UK, they are tailored to your needs. So, you know, you go down for breakfast in the morning and you get, in the US, they'll bring over a pot of coffee. In the UK, they'll bring you over a pot of tea. They'll have different foods on offer. And the same's true in the Middle East. They'll have a lot of variety of Middle Eastern food that's there. In any country that Marriott goes into, they adapt their hotels to meet that country's needs. They'll have different foods available at breakfast. Breakfast will be served at different times, different checkout, check-in procedures. They'll do that by default for all of their hotels. But, you know, and the work I've been doing with Marriott over the years is getting them to do that with their websites as well. So again, Arabic's a good example. So Arabic website, because Arabic and Hebrew both run from right to left.
Oh, that's crazy.
Runs from left to right. Mm-hmm. You have to basically invert your website, like a mirror view of it. So if you had a big, you know, one column on the left and like a big column on the left and a small column on the right, that would be inverted on an Arabic website. So there'd be your small column on the left and your big column on the right. So it's effectively looking at it as a mirror view of your Arabic website, because the text runs in a different way. And that's quite a big design challenge for, you know, a piece of software. If you don't know that you're ever going to need to mirror image your website to hit an Arabic market, you know, you've got to build that effectively into your product from the start. And so it becomes expensive to retrofit it, so you don't bother doing it. And just the translation's not enough if your design isn't a mirror image of your, effectively, your English design.
So
there's loads of things to think about.
Absolutely. So let's imagine we're a software company, since most of our listeners somehow relate to software. We want to expand to foreign market. And as a founder, I know nothing about this new country. Well, maybe I knew something, but not much. What's my framework for building a website or just approaching or entering that market?
Good question. So let's take another popular one is China. Everybody wants to kind of launch a business in China right now. Mm-hmm. So China's a good one. Chinese is a good one. So again, you think, well, okay, we want to go into China. Right. So the first thing we have to check, number one, is the most important thing, is our product appropriate for that market? Is the product going to work in that market? So again, if we're a software company, is our software available in simplified Chinese? Is the interface available in that, number one? Is it possible to do it? Because again, if you're launching an English product into China and the only available language is English, it's not going to happen, because again, the Chinese market, the level of English spoken in China isn't very good. You could do that in Scandinavia. You could do that in Norway. You could launch an English product because education is so good and has been for so long that English is spoken widely and very well. You could launch an English product into Norway, but you couldn't do that into China, for example. So number one, the product's got to fit. And number two, it's got to be in language. And the best way to do that is to basically do a bit of discovery user research. It doesn't have to be massively in depth. It's getting in touch with, just doing a series of interviews with, say, six potential users in that market to understand, is the product something they look for? What are the things that they like about the product? What are the things they dislike about the product? And how would they explain that product to their colleagues? And in doing those and asking those simple questions, effectively, you've got enough to see if your product's going to work there. But then you've also got enough information to, you know, start talking about that product to that country. You know from a user in that country what they like, you know, the things they don't like, so the things to improve. But also in getting them to explain it to a colleague of theirs, you can start writing and understanding how to explain your product to the Chinese market. What are the words that are going to work? So rather than translating your USP from English into Chinese. You get the Chinese market to write you a USP for China.
A little bit of technical detail. They might be a barrier in those interviews because let's say I am a UX pro, but I don't know Chinese. And
do I just get an
interpreter?
No, is the simple answer to that. The complicated answer is the way I work is over the last 13 years, I've built up a network of partners in all the different countries across the world. So any country that I've worked in, I'll go and find a UX freelancer or a small UX agency that will do the research on my behalf, because I completely understand that I don't. And you know what it's like as well. You know, if you're interviewing somebody in Russia about a Russian product, you're going to do it differently. You're going to have to understand. Because you know Russian culture, you'll know the questions to ask and the responses to give. And the best thing about doing qualitative research is trusting the moderator and the UX person doing that research to chase down and ask the right questions in the right way and to go across on tangents because they know they're important. And so I will always get a local native speaker to do the user research, a local, and also get them to do the interpretation of the findings as well. So understanding what and making a prioritized list of the things that they found, I will always get a local person to do that. And then if I want to go and watch that research, and if I want to bring my client or the project team along, then you get an interpreter and you watch the research with an interpreter in the viewing room, and the interpreter will explain to you what's going on. That's the best way to do it, rather than expecting you yourself as the UX person to conduct the user research. Always best to get somebody who knows the country and is a native to do the research for you.
Let me guess what comes next. I guess it's about putting together a micro team to do the same work again on the UX front. Yeah. And then probably the next step would be hiring a copywriter to do the sales page, sales copy in the native language, right?
Exactly. Completely right. So you need a product team. And again, if you've worked with the right UX freelancer to do the research up front, they're the person you get involved on the product team initially. They're the one who represents the user in that country. And again, because they've got UX experience and they've got native user experience from that country, they can give you and be that kind of substitute for the user, like any good UX person should be. But they're on hand to help you make the right design decisions.
What's your take? Is there a career path right there in front of us to be, for example, if you live in a complex country that, I mean, not like Norway, as you mentioned, this is the easiest one, but if you live in an Arabic speaking country or in Japan, you can be one of those accepting UX partners and kind of make that your career profile. Is that true?
Yeah, completely. Absolutely. So a country that's waking up at the moment, like globally, is Thailand. So I've worked with a number of Thai UX people, and they contact me and say, oh, I really want a job in the UK. Can you help me get a job in the UK? And I reply saying, well, look, you don't want to be a small fish in a big pond, which is the UK. You want to be a big fish in a small pond, which is Thailand. Think about starting a UX business in Thailand, because Thailand's a big country. It's got like 40 million people. And, you know, there's a white burgeoning middle class. They've got money to spend. The UX is going to hit quite strongly in Thailand in the next few years and position yourself to be that. So absolutely, I agree. Be the person in that country that does it and build links with user experience people in different countries. So, you know, reach out to people in the US and the UK and in Russia and wherever, and build links with companies that you know want to target the country you're living in. Because again, there's going to be opportunity there in the future for bigger brands that want to hit the Thai market, for example.
If you were to name this kind of person, who would that be? Like a transition facilitator, UX pro. Just
UX pro.
Just UX pro. Local UX pro, right? Yeah. It's fine.
And just on LinkedIn, mm-hmm. set your language, native language, to Thailand, set your place to be at Bangkok. Because when I'm looking for people, I go to LinkedIn and I'll, because Google's rubbish at trying to find people. But LinkedIn's really good because you can type in user experience, freelance, Thailand, and I'll get a list of people who I could work with, for example. And that's a much better way of doing it, because then I can find it, because it's, you know, us UX people, we like to work with other similar like-minded people. So just put a profile in LinkedIn. Don't try and create, you know, a mega UX agency. Just be yourself and just say UX professional, research and design. Because research is probably going to be the biggest draw to people initially for that market, because they want to understand the market before they go there rather than design for it. So always put UX researcher or UX professional in there, but have the word research in your profile.
That's a great piece of advice. So probably step one is research before you commit to building anything in that language. Mm-hmm. When it comes to localizing the product itself, translating the UI, do you have any special recommendations on that?
Again, don't do a translation. So get that UX professional to do it. So again, if I was writing Arabic copy for micro copy, you know how important micro copy is, you know, on those buttons and those navigation tiles and how much time we spend as UX professionals crafting that, that then if you give that to a translation agency, they've got no context about what that means. And they might translate the word really well. So a good example of one I've had is the word book. So book a hotel. So I've had the word book translated into Arabic, and rather than sort of the verb to book as in to make a reservation, they translated it as in the book full of pages of paper. Oh. So the button said, pages of paper book hotel. And it's just like, why? And in the user research, when the user said, why would I want to buy a
book,
get a book about hotels when I just want to make a reservation? And so that's what happens with translation, is it's never done properly in context. So a UX professional who's a native speaker will be able to give you the right word for that thing, or, you know, or obviously user research will give it to you as well. But the place to start is the UX professional, because they'll know the right words to use initially anyway.
That's totally. Is there any kind of advanced quality assurance that needs to be done after everything is complete? Or is it just a typical process?
Other than user research, which, you know, is a good thing to do anyway before you launch a product, I can't say. I mean, translation-wise, generally, yes, because translations, if they're done by an agency, you know, if I get a translation back and it's in simplified Chinese of an article I've written, I've got no way to quality assure if that's any good, that translation. So typically you need somebody who is on your team who speaks the language to tell you if it's any good or not. So hiring, I think you mentioned it earlier on, hiring a marketing person for that country who's a native speaker is a great thing to do in terms of hitting that country. And that person can either be living in that country that they're working at or can be employed at your head office. Both of those are work, but you've got to empower them to say yes or no to anything that you might be doing. Because again, they've got to be on, you know, be able to say, no, that copy doesn't work, or no, that micro interaction isn't right. But you need that empowerment of that native speaker to do it.
Absolutely. If we go one level up to global strategy, and just how do you, are there any wise questions to ask when you try to understand whether the product is going to hit the market or when it's going to miss? Just to evaluate the, you know, the potential risks or something like that when you try to understand whether to go there or not.
That's a very good question. I wish it was that easy. I don't think it's just one question you have to ask. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of have to do the product research you do anyway. So, you know, as UX people, we will always, you know, do research to understand if our product's going to meet our home market. We have to go and do the same for the market we want to hit. And it could be that you use a tool like usertesting.com, because they've got panels of international users. So even if you just sort of set something up with usertesting.com or one of those other online things, to just sort of do a quick test on if the product's going to work or not, it's worth doing it before you spend a lot of money launching in that country only to realize your product's not going to fit. And this is one I see time again in Japan. So Japan's the hardest market to hit, and because the Japanese consumer is different from everybody else in the world, they think a lot about the purchases they make, and they're very considered in everything that they do, and so they won't rush into something unlike anybody in other countries. So and they're also really bad at telling you if your idea is not very good as well. So they can't say no, or often be showing criticism. So again, yes, you absolutely need to do a little bit of research to understand if that market's going to work for you. And if it's not, there's plenty more markets out there that will.
You've seen many countries do that? Well, no. First question, you just gave a perfect description of a Japanese, you know, user or person. Mm-hmm. Is there any resource where we could read about other countries to give that kind of description? Or maybe it's a good idea for you to build a listing?
I would love to do that, yeah. So just a brief description of each country and which ones are the ones worth doing it. There's a few that are more challenging than others. So within Europe. And I don't mind to be, I'm going to say this now, and I'm one of the things you've, I guess you've got to understand is to be an international person is you've got to understand that you are, because I, you know, I'm a white middle-class guy from the UK. I've got to completely understand I'm not my user in any way, shape or form. So what follows might stand a bit stereotypical, but I don't want it to come across that way. But there are markets that are more challenging than others. So within Europe, it's generally France. French people are incredibly proud of their language and who they are. So if you try and launch something that's badly translated or is just in English into France, they will reject it because they're very proud of who they are. Again, similarly in Germany, you've got to make sure the detail's right. So again, if you're translating copy into German, the detail's got to be absolutely right or people will not want to go with you. Because again, and this is such a big, wide stereotype, German people know the detail and look for the detail and much more than anybody else in Europe. So France and Germany, the most challenging two in Europe. It's hard to get people, and this is, I feel so bad with these stereotypes, that within, certainly within Spain and Italy, it becomes much harder to price products properly. And so you have to have a much lower pricing point in Spain and Italy, because again, they're much, you know, if something's $10 or $10 in the US, you've got to almost half that or a third of that to hit Spain and Italy properly, because they don't want to spend as much money online as other markets do. So again, you've got to adjust your pricing for Spain and Italy. And that's just Europe. I could go on to do the same for Asia and Africa as well. It's that all certain countries have certain little quirks that you've got to understand. So a good one is Brazil. In Brazil, they have this concept of paying in installments for something. So it's something that's been around for you know, tens of years in Brazil. So if you go buy a pair of shoes on a high street in Brazil, so maybe the shoes are $50, it's perfectly acceptable to spend $10 on the shoes now, and then over the next 5 months, spend and pay $10 off per month on the cost of those shoes. It's called installment payments, and it's common for everything from TVs to washing machines to shoes to shirts to anything. So to launch a product in Brazil that people pay for, people aren't going to spend $100 up front on something. They're going to want to split that $100 into 10 payments that spread out over the year. And if your payment infrastructure is not set out to hit paying in installments for Brazil, you're going to fail epically. You will not sell anything online in Brazil, because everybody that's successful in e-commerce allows payment in installments for everything that people buy. And so if you can't do that, you're going to fail miserably in Brazil, for example.
Amazing example. I'd love to ask you, have you launched anything in Russia yet?
I have, yes.
What's your brief take on Russia? Just curious.
So the interesting thing about Russia, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, I'm always open to being saying, no, that's not right. The big thing about Russia is there's two very different sets of people in Russia. There's people who are sort of 45, 50 and older, who are kind of effectively slightly pre-communist era, where English wasn't taught at school, or the English level of their English is pretty poor. And then there's people who are younger, who have learned English more at school and college, and so speak English better and are more adept at navigating websites in English. Because again, the alphabet is completely different from English to the Cyrillic alphabet that you use in Russia. So there's two very different consumers there. And so if you're trying to work with a businessman who's 55 in Russia, he might speak some English, but almost certainly he's going to have an assistant who does a lot of the work for him who won't speak very good English. And she might be a woman who's slightly older. So you've really got to understand the two splits of those two users. And so that means that everything has to be written in Russian, as you know, Jane. Mm-hmm. And also because Yandex, the search engine in Russia, is much bigger than Google, you're not going to rank, so people can't find your product if you're not in Russian, because Yandex will index stuff in Russian much more and prioritize that over content in English. So you kind of have to understand those two types of users, and that you've absolutely got to do it in Russian to meet the Yandex so you can get to the people you need to get to. Is that sound about right, Jane?
You've
am
got
I,
a
am I right on
pre-
that?
Pretty accurate estimate, I think. You just classified probably the top tier of users who are the most literate, because there is always people who just don't buy software online and just don't do that. Yeah. But generally speaking, I think you're right.
Because you probably correct me on this, but all the user research I've done in Russia I see everybody uses like translation services. So they'll use like, they'll translate everything into Russian. So they'll be very, very, very used to putting their website through a translation service to translate it into Russian. And that's so common because there wasn't that many pages in Russia in Russian, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. There are a lot more now. Is that still common, Jane, that people constantly use the translation services to translate stuff?
I don't know, because I don't work with Russian markets anymore for the last like 5 years. And myself, I don't experience that problem, as you might guess, because I can just read in English. But yeah, it might be. Yeah, why not? The translation engines are pretty good these days, so you can figure out it yourself.
Yeah, I think Yandex's one's very good. And I think that's the difference, is that in other countries like Thailand, like Google Translate for Thailand is not very good at all. So you can't expect your Thai users to do the same. And Japanese users will never use the translation service ever. And there were French users on principle. So it's like Russia, you can sort of get away with an English website if you've got a good translation service associated with it. So it's different markets have different expectations for language. It's fascinating stuff.
Actually, I have a friend working for Yandex for a while already, and she goes to conferences on their behalf and says that we should be proud of this search engine because it's pretty much like it's a big ecosystem, and it's like a research institution, same as Google is for the States. It's pretty big.
It's fantastic. Yandex is fantastic. You know, Yandex as a company and as a search engine is a great business, and one, you know, that I find endlessly fascinating. So yeah, I'd love to chat to the people at Yandex. Good people.
Okay, I have another question. Now we've discussed, you know, language barriers, but what if there are few English speaking countries, primarily the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom and Australia. What's the, there might be some, you know, obstacles in moving between these markets. Can you recall some of them for us?
Yeah. So a funny example. So when I worked with a company about 4 years ago, and they were just launching from the US company. They were launching into the UK, and their homepage to meet the UK, or their UK homepage to meet the UK audience, had it's hilarious. It had pictures of red double-decker buses, policemen with tall hats,
seriously,
black taxis, seriously. And it's like, I said to them, I said, look, if I was a UK person launching a website into the US, would I show cowboys and surfer dudes from California on my homepage? Of course I wouldn't. That's the stereotypical view of that audience. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of that you can stereotype an audience quite strongly, and you can end up designing, showing things for them that are, you know, don't work. But the major difference is in the subtlety within British speaking and American speaking. So American copy tends to be more direct, shorter, and the grammar is different. British copy tends to be a bit more, if you're writing for a British audience, tends to be a bit more, I wouldn't say better written, but more, there's more depth to it.
Like artistic?
Again, artistic slightly more, mm-hmm. And less direct. We, you know, us Brits are less direct than our American cousins. And then Canada's slightly different again, and it shares a bit of that UK culture and a bit of that US culture. So, you know, it takes a lot of UK spellings and pronunciations, as well as some of that US directness. And then again, Australia is completely different again. So the needs and wants of the Australian market are very, very different to the stuff in the US and the UK. Because Australia is such a huge, sparsely populated country that you've got to write about and do stuff a bit differently because of that geography a bit more over in Australia. And then Australia is also different to New Zealand, and you've got to write a bit differently for New Zealand audiences to Australian audiences. So there are subtle differences there, but you can't treat them as all being the same. You really can't, because you're not going to be a successful in the UK if you're not having British people write your copy for you if you're in a US company, and vice versa as well.
So let's imagine a situation where you are a bootstrap founder and you have limited funds, but you kind of feel that your local market has exhausted itself for some reason. Maybe it's too narrow or something like that. So, and you don't have much money to do all these big thing and make a team and really good research. Would you recommend just go from the top of your head, translate the website as well as you can and go for it, or better not?
It depends how much, because again, you only get one opportunity to create a first impression of your product. So I'll talk about Holland. Holland is a good example. So the people in Holland speak really good English. You know, they're taught it from school. They are, you know, very, very good at English. They watch, you know, movies in English, but they're not perfect at writing English. You know, it's very hard. This difference between speaking a language and writing a language is big. And so I see a lot of Dutch companies launching in the UK and their copy is just a bit off. It's English, but it's not quite right, the English. And it's really disconcerting for me as a Brit. I'm like, what do they mean? This sounds a bit weird. They sound a bit, you know, is their education level any good? Is this a real product? Do I trust them? And again, if you're Dutch, you might think, well, I speak English. I speak very good English. Why would I need to get it translated into English when I do that? So at the very least, the number one thing you can do as a bootstrap founder is find a native speaker and ask them just to review your copy for grammar and spelling problems, you know, once it's translated. And there's a good service. Do you know Fiverr? F-I-V-E, I think, RRR.com?
Double R, I think. Yeah, it's a service for small jobs. You can get transcriptions there, other stuff.
Mm-hmm. All that stuff, you know, web copy. You can basically find a native speaker on Fiverr who will, you know, charge you a few dollars an hour just to review your copy and tell you if it what is wrong. You know, what grammatical errors you've made. So even if you spend $20 and get somebody to look at your site for 4 or 5 hours and make some recommendations on copy, that's going to put you in a better position than not doing it. And people aren't going to go, that's weird. Why have they put that word on that button? And, you know, again, Scandinavian countries launching in the UK, it happens quite a lot. Spend the money on something like Fiverr, even if it's just $20, and get a native speaker to have a little cursory glance over what you're doing.
You can actually go a little bit further, maybe find someone on Upwork called an editor who have a little bit advanced, or a copywriter who can do that for you a little bit better level.
You can, absolutely can. But it's, you know, that's that difference between spending $20 on it, $100 on
right.
it. But you're right, both of those things would work, but it's how much you want to spend to kind of do it, really. But yeah, getting a native speaker to do it, and like you say, an editor or a writer or whatever, they're gonna get you the obvious stupid things that you've done wrong.
I'd love to have your take on international websites, just in general. What do you think from the UX perspective? How do you arrange your multiple international sites? Do you present everyone those terrible, you know, country pickers? Do you land people automatically on their IP? What's the best practice?
So the best thing to understand what website to give somebody is the browser language string. So again, if they've got their browser set up, then most people generally have their browser set up for their right language because it's based on their operating system, which, you know, that's the best way to do it. You can use IP as well. But the number one default should be, well, what language is the default one that this person speaks, and give them that. The whole world of flags and selecting a flag is a really dreadful idea because it's very hard to organize it. And it's just a step that a lot of people can't be bothered with, and people drop out. So yeah, use language string number one as the browser, and as a backup would be IP as well. So language and country are not the same thing. So again, if I am a Chinese speaker and you say, oh, look, he's got his language in his browser set as simplified Chinese, probably I'll be in China, but I may well be living in, there's a big Chinese population in Malaysia. There's a big Chinese population in Singapore. There's Chinese populations outside of China, unless Taiwan. You can't be sure that I want my currency, for example, in UN. I don't want in the Chinese currency. I might want it in a different currency. So use language to set that up for the browser string, and then use IP to set my currency to the local currency if you support it, like Singapore dollars versus Chinese yuan or something like that. So again, it's often a cascade of different signs that you can use to help decide where you think that person is.
There are globally popular websites like, I don't know, booking.com comes to mind because they juggle all these currencies and everything. Do you think they're doing it right?
Booking.com is probably the best. They're one of the best at international that I've seen. They do it incredibly well. They get it from a really fundamental level, the difference between language and country, and how to serve up different stuff to different people. So, you know, if you go to the booking.com website and you're in the UK, you'll see a whole different set of destinations to the one you go in. If you go and see it in Amsterdam, you know, in Holland or Belgium or whatever, they get the fact that based on where you are, you want to see different things, not just a different translation of what you're doing. You want to see a different set of products. And they're very, very good at it. And I know that their conversion numbers for different international locations are, you know, comparable with their native market, which is, you know, might surprise a few people, is Amsterdam, is Holland. That's where they started. So they're very, very good at this stuff. So if you want to go and get some ideas and copy the best of the best, go and copy booking.com.
Any other good examples?
That was the one I was going to use if you asked me that question. So now I've got to think of another one.
Oh, let's talk about Amazon, for example. That's always throwing me between UK and US for no reason.
Amazon aren't very good at this. Amazon aren't as good as people make it out to be. They've got a strong brand and cheap prices, so they can afford not to be very good at this stuff. So Amazon aren't the best, I'd say, in terms of this stuff at all. They're really not very good at this. You know, they'll kind of try and give you the right site, and then off you go on your own website to do it. But I wouldn't hold Amazon in a high regard for this stuff at all, really. They're really not. They're just, you know, they are who they are. And so people will always try and spend money with them, even if there's Amazon make it as difficult as possible, which they often do.
I hear you very well. So we need to wrap it up, but this is an amazing conversation. I'd love to spend the last 5 minutes with you talking about Japan and China and why Chinese people call you Red Bean Joe. I saw that a couple of times on your website and your Twitter.
So I don't know if you ever work with Chinese people when they come to Europe. They often will choose a British or an English name because they think it's easier for people to relate to them, and they won't be able to pronounce their Chinese name. So they always choose a Chinese name. So I remember I worked on a project a few years ago for Hotels.com, and I remember working with a project manager who called herself Lemon, and the designer, he called himself Coffee. And they always choose a lot of Justines as well. There's always a lot of Justines and Jasons. There's a lot of, they choose those names because they're really popular. And so it's interesting. So I was like, well, hold on a minute. You guys are all choosing a kind of an English name to make it easier for you. I should choose a Chinese name for them. And so we were going out for, dinner, and I was reading the menu. It was a bad translation on this menu. And, I was reading it, and the dish was called chili sticky tofu. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting, chili sticky tofu. And I said to the waiter, I want this chili sticky tofu. And the waiter was like, are you sure you want that, sir? And I'm like, yeah, I want the chili sticky tofu. And he's like, are you sure, sir? And I'm like, yeah. And I thought he was thinking it was maybe too spicy for me. Anyway, I ordered it. And as it came out of the kitchen, I've never smelt anything as awful as this toffee. Honestly, the kitchen door opened and the smell was like awful. And so they'd mistranslated sticky as stinky, and stinky is like this delicacy, which is this sort of it's fermented in fish for like fish sauce for like a week. So it's like, you can imagine that smell, like a week old fish smell of this tofu. And the project team were all laughing at me, ha ha ha. And I was like, oh, this is awful. So, you know, I didn't want my nickname to be sticky or stinky. So we went out afterwards. I want something that reminds me of the UK. I've had an awful time with Chinese food. I want an ice cream. So we went to this ice cream seller, and I thought, I'm going to order that strawberry ice cream there. So I said, can I have this one? And pointed to the red one that looked like strawberry. Anyway, it wasn't strawberry ice cream. It was red bean ice cream, which is really popular in China. And so I sort of bit into it. And the last thing I wanted after the stinky tofu was like I wanted something that was familiar, like a strawberry ice cream, and it was bean ice cream, and it was like tasted awful, and I felt, and all the team were laughing at me. So yeah, they call me Red Bean Joe is my nickname in Chinese, which is Dong Hao Joe, which is Red Bean Joe.
That's a great story. So you mentioned that Japanese market is like a secret box or something like that, especially unique. Why is that?
Because Japan, you know, the history of Japan and the internet is that a lot of the internet grew up through a kind of almost closed wall internet, through Docomo, which is the sort of equivalent mobile internet. So the mobile internet took off really strongly in Japan in about 2004, and they had their own version of the mobile webs set up by Docomo over there, and everything was this protocol, which was different from WAP, which was very big in Japan. So they got used to having their own mobile internet over there. And Also, the history of a lot of Japanese companies is they've never responded very well to international brands. Some of them they have, but many of them they haven't. They've always been quite, you know, as a culture, preferring to go with Japanese-owned brands and Japanese-created brands, because they always say things to you like, people, nobody understands Japanese people like Japanese people. Nobody understands the needs and the things that I want. That nobody understands the food that I want, or the hotels that I want, or the products that I want. And it's true, to launch anything in Japan is very difficult, because Japanese people like products that are very focused on their own wants and needs. And so, number one, your product is probably not going to fit 100% the market, because they are typically will always strive to work towards Japanese products because they perceive them to be fitting themselves better. But then also they're used to the way that their own internet previously worked, and they have their own sort of style of website design, which was informed by that slightly. So they were, because of this walled garden that came on these mobile phones, they weren't used to seeing US or European websites at all, because they didn't, you know, this closed garden of websites wasn't on, you know, these sites weren't on Docomo's network. So they just didn't see them. So that when the iPhone came along, which is by number one, it's the best-selling phone in now in Japan, you know, and they saw a British or a badly translated UK website, they were like, oh, it was a surprise to them. It was a new thing to them, because they'd had 5 years of experience of using this walled garden of Docomo's website, where everything was written for the Japanese audience by Japanese people, of products that were designed for the Japanese audience. So when US brands started to launch mobile websites over there, they just weren't right. They weren't getting things right. And so it's an uphill struggle. You have to be absolutely 100% correct in everything you do to do well in Japan.
When you're doing that, not going back from Japan to general questions, just one little question. Can you count on the audience to be responsive to the general, you know, there is a general culture of web, which is probably originates from the States, I think. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Would you count on people still understanding that aesthetics and that, you know, take on design?
Yeah, I mean, so you know, design patterns like navigation at the top, you know, that kind of classic search box goes on the top right or top left if you're Arabic countries. That's kind of sort of very classic website placement stuff is pretty universal. Aesthetics is a different thing. So aesthetics, I'd say no, that's not very well understood internationally. So I'll take the example of Marriott and their hotel. So if you go to a Marriott hotel in India, and I've done loads of work in India, you know, you sort of go there, and the concierge, his uniform, he's maybe a Sikh gentleman, and he's got like a Marriott designed headdress. He's got a Marriott design. He's got a Marriott jacket, but it's very Indian because it's got loads of jewels encrusted in it, but it's in the Marriott colours. So it's clearly Marriott because it's the Marriott colours, but it's clearly Indian because it's the Indian look. And the biggest thing that international websites and website designers generally is they can't often mix their own aesthetic of that country with the design of, you know, the conventions that you come out of Silicon Valley. So, you know, the designs of Airbnb. They'll just copy Airbnb's design, but don't, for example, in India, they won't put their own Indian feel to that that design they've done. Or in Arabic countries, they won't put that Arabic feel to that design that's there. They'll just copy a US one, thinking, well, if the US are doing it, it must be the correct way of doing it, rather than attempting to include their own design aesthetic there. Same is true of China. How do you put Chinese flavor, Indian flavor, Arabic flavor into your design to make it feel part of that world while still keeping the design conventions that, you know, you've learned from US websites, for example?
But let's say there are brand guidelines that are assumed to be applied internationally. But for example, if you look at local, I'm totally speculating here. I don't know. But let's say local websites are including ornaments or some like rich decorations or something like textures. Yeah. But you're Airbnb owner, what do you do? Do you add decorations?
No, you have a design review process that makes it still feel like Airbnb. But if you have a prescriptive design pattern language that was written by Californian, young Californian people in California.
Right.
It's not going to translate to India. It never will. And if you try and enforce it, you're never going to succeed. You have to understand that there are reasons to adapt your design to that market. And there's a huge rich flavor of design, especially in the Arabic nations. The design history of Arab within the Arabic countries is beautiful. And why wouldn't you want that as part of your design? It's not like it's going to be ugly. It's just going to be feel very Airbnb, but feel have Islamic design conventions as part of it. It doesn't have to be conflicting. It's just you as a design and creative team need to understand that you need to take input from these countries and create something that feels like Airbnb, but still feels like it's Arabic or it's Indian or it's Chinese, or you're never going to succeed. It'll just feel like a Californian company. You know?
Right.
It'll always feel that way.
That was a perfect conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. When people want to learn more from you, where can they find you online?
So mrjoe.uk, mrjoe.uk is my website. I share loads of stuff. On international, I've just written an article about how to write English for second language speakers. So how to write your English so it can be understood by people who don't speak English as a native language, for example.
It's great. I read it. It's great.
It's very kind of you. So go and have a look at that. And yeah, my website, I write loads of stuff. I'm also on Twitter. I'm Mr. Joe, M-R-J-O-E. And I share loads of international stuff and psychology stuff on there as well. Those two are the best places. So mrjoe.uk or Mr. Joe on Twitter.
And
it's also a good place to go.
I know you have a gift for our listeners, which is...
Yes. So I've got a book called Psychology for Designers, which normally retails at £2.50 or $4, €4. But I am happy to give it away to listeners, a free ebook of that if you'd like it. So if you go to mrjoe.uk/freebook, all one word, free book, FREEBOOK, you can download a free copy of Psychology for Designers yourself.
That's amazing. You're super generous. Thank you so much.
Oh, no worries.
Well, hope your design endeavors just blossom. And thank you once again. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very
much.
Have
a great day.
You too, Jane. Thanks very much for your time.